This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. I have a secret to tell from my electrical well. It's a simple message, and I'm leaving out the whistles and bells. Now, people will be saying, what, is he cracked finally? Has he gone mad? The lyrics there to Birdass in My Soul by They Might Be Giants. The only song I'm aware of, pop song certainly, to contain the word filibuster. Now, again, people are saying, what is this pop master with Ken Bruce? No, it's not, but I offer you that as an extra. You see, a lot of podcasts, that'd be enough. They want your money for that. But here at the Snooker Scene Podcast, we like to inform and we like to entertain. And occasionally, we do one or the other. Speaking of entertaining, we've just had the Riyadh Season World Masters of Snooker, the first staging of the event, much talked about, won by Ronnie O'Sullivan. It always seems he's like the obvious winner in a way to these new tournaments. He always seems to, if there's a new tournament, to win it. He won the first Champion of Champions, he won the first Tour Championship, he won the Hong Kong event, strictly speaking, not the first one, but it was in that big arena last season. And now he's won this tournament in Riyadh. We're going to be discussing this later because we've had emails about it. But we must congratulate him. It was a mixed performance, as it often is from him. He was brilliant against John Higgins, just superb. Not really that great against Judd Trump. And Trump, at the moment, seems to be on that list of players that can't beat him. For a while, he did beat him. But at the last few meetings, he's struggled, really. And then in the final from 2-1 down against Purcell, he was superb. He was clearly inspired by the prestige of the tournament, let's not kid ourselves, the money on offer. That got his juices flowing. And as I say, we'll be talking about Saudi Arabia later, but we straight to the top of the list of the emails, Snooker Royalty is written in, because Herman Ardalan is the man behind snooker.org. Now this is, well, it's snooker's longest running website. It was one of the first. For a long time, it was only him, that website, and Global Snooker Centre, run by Janie Watkins. That was the only sort of source of information for snooker on the internet. And he's kept it going. It's a vast statistical resource. He's got a team who help him with all the results, and not just professional circuit, but women's events and all sorts of tournaments, amateur events. It's a brilliant website. I'm sure everybody listening to this is aware of that already. He's done a fantastic job for the game, for no reward other than he loves the game and wants to contribute to it, very much like Q-Tracker. Ron Florax there and the team he has. Just brilliant, invaluable websites. And Herman has written in. He says, forever listener, first time writer. Thank you very much for the great podcast. I love to hear your well thought out views on the current snooker topics. Perhaps even more so, I enjoy your dry wit and self-deprecating humour. Thank you, Herman. He says, I don't care what any award says. The Snooker Scene Podcast will always be number one on my list. Very kind of you. He says, I had the pleasure of meeting you and the wonderful Janie Watkins at the 2000 European Championships in Stirling. I still have a photo of me proudly lifting the World Championship trophy. Anyway, enough with the pleasantries. There is, after all, some point to this email. A few eons ago, you requested input on how people around the world view snooker. That got me thinking of our arrangement here in Oslo in the 90s. After BBC World stopped broadcasting from the Crucible in 1994, we had no way of watching the World Championship. Luckily, though, through my website, www.snooker, I got in touch with the very friendly Martin Bell in Northern Ireland. Every year, he duly recorded the whole event on VHS and shipped it up north to me and my mates. Of course, later Eurosport came to the rescue with live coverage. But nothing will ever beat that box of cassettes arriving in mid-May. Thanks for patiently wading through this unnecessarily long email. Long may we hear your voice on all kinds of devices. Thank you, Herman. Well, there's a lot in that. And firstly, your trip to Stirling. I mean, it's a long time ago now, but I remember it. And my memory is this, OK? You can correct this if it's wrong. I think then, and I'm sure it's the case now, you're a big Stephen Hendry fan. And, of course, that was where Stephen always practised, in Stirling, in Spencer's there. And I think you're hoping to meet him. Now, my memory is you were told, oh, well, it's summer. He won't be in. And you went off on a sightseeing tour, I think, of Stirling. And on the day you were on the sightseeing tour, he did actually come in the club. And you missed him. But I don't know whether you caught up with him later. I don't know. But you can correct all of that. I may be remembering it incorrectly. It's quite a romantic tale there, the tapes arriving. Firstly, hats off to Martin Bell. I'm guessing it's not the former BBC War reporter you were talking about, who wore that white suit and became an MP later. Again, information that adds to the story. I'm guessing it's not him, or indeed the skier. But good of him to record the whole thing. It's worth saying, though, you know, people forget there was a time before Eurosport where people around Europe couldn't follow it. It was very much a British thing in those days. And now it is a world thing, and it's on streaming services. And I know sometimes they're not all as reliable as they could be, but it is easier now to watch it than it used to be, for sure. I think Rolf Kalb used to send away for tapes in Germany as well. So the dedication of snooker fans is writ large here. Thank you, Herman, and congratulations for the site, for the longevity of it, and do keep it going, because we all use it and we all have a lot of respect for it. Now, of course, we've had the tournament in Riyadh, so we've had a few emails on this. Now, Alpha Bonzi is going to set the ball rolling, as he often does, regular correspondent. He says, after Ronnie takes the sweet Saudi money in Riyadh, my three quick ones are, number one, it's been a good 3 days for Matchroom, for World Snooker and for the local promoter. Has it been a good 3 days for pro snooker? Number two, do you sense this event will return next season, or will it disappear for the next 5 years like the Hong Kong Masters? Number three, how long would it take the players to receive their prize money, and how do the players receive it, whether it be from the local promoter or World Snooker? Why does it take up to 3 months to get money from the Chinese events? On that point, I'm not entirely sure, because I imagine every sort of locale is different. But I think if you watch the event, it's pretty clear money's not an issue, really, so there's no reason why they shouldn't get it quickly. China is a different thing. I know the players are unhappy about that and are trying to resolve it. And as a freelance, I have sympathy for them, because there's nothing worse than, you know, you've done the work, you weren't paying for it, and you spend a lot of unnecessary time chasing payment. And anyone in the freelance world knows what that's like. In terms of whether it will return, well, it will. And that's really answering your first question. Has it been a good 3 days for snooker? I would say yes. The event was a success. We know that because His Excellency, who put the money in, announced that he was doubling the prize for the Golden Ball maximum next year, which means it will be on next year. So will it disappear for the next 5 years? No. Obviously, we don't know. I mean, the Turkish Masters was announced as a 5-year deal. It was on once. There were reasons behind that that were related to the local economy. I don't think that will be an issue in Saudi Arabia. We know the ranking event's been announced for 10 years. But I think it was a good 3 days for snooker. The event got a lot of publicity. I mean, John Higgins was on for the Golden Maximum, which for me was really thrilling. He got to 120, came awkward on the yellow, missed it. That was reported on the BBC Breakfast Sports News Bulletin the next morning on BBC One. Now, they very rarely cover snooker. I remember getting, this is true, I got into a spat with one of their presenters online years ago, because it was during the World Championship and there was no mention of it in the sports news. And I pointed out the BBC was showing it for 17 days and it's our World Championship. And he sort of said, well, he didn't think it was, you know, newsworthy enough. So the worm has turned there. This innovation, gimmick, publicity stunt, call it what you want, it did attract a lot of attention. There was a lot of talk about it. I actually think, and kudos here to Jan Verhaas and Paul Collier, they came up with the rules for it. It was executed perfectly in terms of how it worked. It didn't get in the way of the snooker. It was the ball, as I'm sure you know, was taken off the table when the maximum wasn't possible, and then it just became a normal frame of snooker again. And I think that worked really well. But when Higgins was on for it, I defy anybody to tell me that wasn't exciting. It was. He was excited, certainly. And, you know, he got far closer than anyone else did. It was a new market for the game, and you can see the potential there for sure. I thought the players acquitted themselves well. There was some comment that they were a bit gushing in some of the things they said, but I suppose what would we rather? Would we rather they went there and disrespected the culture and didn't and weren't professional? They behaved in the way you would expect top golfers, top tennis players to behave. And if we have any ambitions to be anywhere near that level, then that's how players have to behave. They weren't under instructions to do it. Anyone who thinks they were don't understand snooker players. But clearly they found themselves in the middle of something that they can see the potential for. So it was in their interests to play ball, and they did. I mean, Ronnie O'Sullivan is often painted as this great rebel, but if it's in his interests, he's the best behaved person there, and he said all the right things, and you could see at the end when it was announced that the, you know, the golden ball is going to be worth $1 million next year, you could see the absolute delight in his face. And why not? Why wouldn't there be? So I thought they behaved really professionally. They mingled with the fans, and they represented the sport well. And of course, what they always do when they play is represent the sport well. That's the thing. That Tuesday was a fantastic day of snooker, quarterfinals day. Really exciting. The Mark Allen, Mark Selby decider was unbelievable. Just one of the most amazing frames I've ever seen. It was up there with Colin Wilson and Tim McGill, their decider at the Crucible back in 2020. All sorts of things happening. It ended with Ronnie O'Sullivan's virtuoso performance against John Higgins, who didn't pot a ball against him. So that was a great day of snooker. The final was exciting. Great performance from O'Sullivan. It would be nice if it was closer. But on the table, as you would expect with the quality of the field, it was really good. The highlight for me was right at the end. The local fans, and there's been criticism, which I don't entirely always, I'm not entirely always on board with, but there's been criticism that certainly the British events, the audience, it's all middle-aged white men, it's not diverse, it's all the same sort of people. That was not the case here. There were fans there who had never seen professional snooker live before, from the Arab world, men and women. And at the end, when Ronnie O'Sullivan won, they were clamouring for selfies. They could not have been more euphoric, more excited. And I thought that was fantastic to see a new audience embracing this sport that many of us in the UK in particular loved for decades. And let's be clear, people who are against the tournament are against people experiencing that. There's some of the comment on the event is quite parochial, actually. It's coming from the idea of Western superiority. You know, our values outstrip yours, so we'll decide where the game goes. I thought it was brilliant that those people got to experience that. I'd like the game to be as international as possible, and for as many people around the world to have the chance to watch an event like that and be part of it like that. So on that basis, yes, to answer Alpha's question, it was good for the game. The other measure, and this is a literal measure, is the viewing figures on Eurosport were brilliant. They were entirely in line with what you'd expect for a ranking event. The Tuesday in particular, the audience was pretty much maintained all day. It peaked in the evening just before the football and just after the football. People went away to watch football but came back. Figures for the final were really good. So any suggestion there was a mass boycott by snooker fans is simply false. There wasn't. A lot of people are seduced by things said on Twitter. In the real world, lots of people watched it, just as they watch all the other events. It was another snooker tournament to most people, and they watched it and they enjoyed it. And the figures bear that out. So again, that's good for the game. So that's my answer to your question. Our friend Lars Johansson from Canada, who I met in York, we'll come back to the other points you make, Lars, later, because they're not related to Saudi, but the one question you did ask was, do you know what prompted Jack Nazowski to wear the traditional Saudi Arabian garb during the first day of snooker, but not afterwards? Did someone get offended? Was it requested by the organisers that he wear that? It wasn't. I thought he looked ridiculous, frankly, wearing that. And not because it would have caused offence. I don't think it did, actually. But because what message does that send? Day one of the tournament surely is about, you're trying to set the tone for what the event is. And the event was very prestigious. So therefore, why is he dressed like that? It didn't make any sense to me. And you're right, he didn't do it again afterwards. It just seemed odd, that's all, that he would do that. I don't know whose idea it was. And listen, I don't think it was a big deal actually out there. I don't think anybody took offence at it. it's just a sort of thing, it's sort of almost fancy dress in a way, which you might wear at the shootout maybe, but I'm sure he was trying to sort of make a point about, look, we're here and we're happy to be here, but it was odd, and I think it backfired, frankly. But that was a small point. I mean, I love Jack. He's brilliant. And, he's very engaging, but that was an odd choice, I think. Now, we've had other views on this tournament. Jennifer Best, I've listened with interest to all the views from yourself and listeners over the last few weeks regarding the tournament in Saudi Arabia. It's been a very lively debate, and it's great that the podcast provides space for fans to air their opinions. One of the things that strikes me is that the debate has been more two-sided among the fans than among those within the sport. Some people might argue that's because people within the sport know what's best for the game, but I would suggest if snooker wasn't such a male-dominated sport and apparently heterosexual, the debate would be different. I think the dismissal of human rights concerns through some weak arguments is pretty disheartening and looks like textbook rationalisation to me. If I'm honest, I've fallen a bit out of love with snooker over the last few weeks. I've not watched any of the Eurosport coverage as I normally would, not because I think it'll make any difference, but because I don't see myself represented, and in fact never have done. All I see is a bunch of already wealthy white men chasing a stupid golden ball for a ridiculous amount of money like performing monkeys in a country where women are openly viewed as being of less value than men. If anyone needs any evidence of that, take a look at the Saudi government's own website on women's rights. What I have seen on social media has turned my stomach, e.g. Ken Doherty doing a piece to camera with veiled women in the background, Tatiana Woolston wearing a loose-fitting outfit substantially different to her male counterparts and what she normally wears, or Jack Lazowski's dodgy turn in a dish dash. I'm hoping I'll get my snooker mojo back in time for the mixed doubles, as I'll be in Manchester willing the women on. However, at the moment, the sport is looking a little grubby to me. Thank you, Jennifer. Very eloquently argued. I'll come back to some of the points later, but Kelly Barker has got an opposite opinion. She says, I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed watching the Riyadh World Masters, a super 3 days with the very best players in the world. What was not to like? Snooker spreading its wings in a new territory and a ranking event to follow can only be good for the game. Of course, I'm not saying that I agree with some of the human rights issues over there, but as someone who's not particularly bothered about gossip and scandal, I thought the negative reaction to the event on Twitter was a bit much. I was criticised by someone for enjoying sports washing. Nonsense. I'm a snooker fan who just enjoys the action on the table, whether it's the world final or a lowly qualifying match and everything in between. I hope the negative people feel better for not watching it and happier to have their morals intact. A few changes needed for the ranking event there, I think, and hopefully that'll be a great event too. Session times probably need to be earlier, as the 3 a.m. finish probably wasn't the best for any of them. Anyway, a great couple of months ahead now to enjoy. I'm already getting into the World Championship spirit. See you there. I hope so, Kelly. Philip from Madison, Wisconsin, excuse me, he says, I initially dismissed the idea of the Golden Ball as a gimmick and didn't want to watch the Saudi event, especially given its negative associations with the Saudi government. But let's be honest, I'd watch anything they throw at me if it's played on a 12-by-6-foot snooker table by the top players. So off the moral high horse I came and watched the tournament I went. First, I have to say, I find the spray-painted golden snooker table tasteless and tacky. Someone please tell the Saudis that there are ways to show off their wealth without making everything gold-coloured. But the golden ball is genius as a marketing ploy, and it has generated an incredible amount of buzz. Watching John Higgins' attempt live was very exciting. Apparently this event will return next year with an insane $1 million bonus for the 167. Which brings me to my thought question. I think World Snooker Tour should negotiate with the Saudis so that they can partially fund the rest of the tour. Basically give a portion of their investment to WST so that they can use it to boost the prize fund of the other tournaments, support low-ranked players, amateur events, etc. If they're going to take the Saudis' money, they might as well take full advantage of it. Do you think this is reasonable? Is WST considering something like this? As always, I've thoroughly enjoyed your commentary and podcast. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Philip. What you suggest is interesting, certainly. I think this. Put it this way, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. So we're now involved with Saudi money. I suppose the question is, how far does it go? Is it a case in 3 years' time they say, we want the World Championship, here's X amount of million pounds for it, thank you very much? Or are they happy to dip their toe into the water and have a couple of tournaments a year? I'm not sure. Well, everyone has a price. Now, World Snooker Tour control the professional circuit. To what extent would they be open to other investment? I think it would depend how much it was and what the terms were. But I think everybody wants more money in the game. And I did ask a question a few weeks ago on this podcast that nobody's answered. What I said was, to everybody who thinks there should be more money in the game, who thinks it should grow, and who thinks it should be more international, if this arrangement with the Saudis is not the answer, then what is? Nobody's answered that. Your view is quite interesting, I think. Now then, Duncan... Well, Duncan sent two emails. The first was saying that he wouldn't be watching the event, which is perfectly fine. You don't have to. The second one said this. I've just listened to your always excellent podcast. Were the commentators under instructions not to mention the non-existent crowds in Saudi Arabia? It would have been mentioned if it happened here. Then you talk about your tips for the World Championship, which we will come to later, but we're still on the Saudi subject. The answer to that question is no, we weren't under instructions. Instructions from who? I mean, I can only talk for the Eurosport commentary. There was World Feed commentary. There was other commentary going out in the local language. I can only talk for Eurosport, who I commentated for. The Saudi promoters sent no instructions. World Snooker Tour sent no instructions. And even if they did, we're not under any obligation to follow them. And I had no instructions from Eurosport either. I never have done, actually. I've never had any instructions from anybody about what I should say or should not talk about or anything like that, ever. That's a fact. Even when I do Judgment Day for World Snooker, they never say you've got to say this or you can't say that, because they understand that I kind of know already what the boundaries are. On the crowds, the day one was poor. There's no getting away from that. Day two, it built up, and by the end, it was really good. And the crowds for the final were really good, and I've already spoken about the atmosphere there and the audience getting the chance to see the snooker. The reason, there's two reasons I didn't go overboard talking about it. The first is the same reason I don't in China or didn't in Hull last year for the Tour Championship, where the crowds were pretty poor early on. And that is, there's no real benefit to the game to dwell on that. People can see it for themselves and they can judge it for themselves. They don't need editorialising from the commentators. The second reason is, and this is more the reason, I guess, is that I don't have enough knowledge about the culture of live attendances in that part of the world. I was told by some of the guys who played in the Dubai Classic years ago, 30 years ago, the attendances weren't great then. I don't know enough about the culture of attending live sporting events to comment on the setup there. I don't know enough about the price of tickets, the nature of how they were sold, who they were sold to, the area the tournament's been played in, how accessible it is, to form judgments on that. Now, that didn't stop a lot of other people doing that, I know. But again, that was confusing to me, because so many people said they were against the event because of human rights, and we've heard Jennifer very eloquently argue that point. That's fine. So why then attack it for the attendances? I thought you're against it because of human rights. What difference does it make in the end how many people go? But that's the answer. I don't know enough about live attendances out there and the way the tickets were sold and who they were sold to and the area to know. What I have done in the last couple of days is speak to some people who went to Riyadh and worked on the event. And they had mixed views about how it went, but they said the actual the people there were very friendly, very enthusiastic. And I spoke to someone who'd spoke to some fans afterwards who were actually from the UK, but they were absolutely buzzing about the fact that, you know, they work out there and they got the chance to see, snooker close up, which, for a lot of people was for the first time. Jennifer and Kelly put forward different sides of the argument, and the argument has been quite well established now, I think, about, you know, whether to go or not to go to Saudi Arabia, whether to take the money or not to take the money. I heard a very interesting discussion on sport in Saudi Arabia. It wasn't about snooker, it was primarily about boxing, but it's on a new podcast called The Sports Agents with Gabby Logan and Mark Chapman. And they were talking, as I say, to a boxing journalist actually about Saudi Arabian money, but in sport more generally. And it was the most nuanced discussion by far that I've heard so far. Gabby Logan was saying, as a woman, she feels uncomfortable as a sports fan about supporting the events out there because women don't have the same rights as men. And, you know, freedom of expression is repressed. But she also said and pointed out that the Saudis have invested heavily in women's sport. There's a women's football league that didn't exist several years ago. So is that sports washing or is that progress? I think the point is, these arguments are a lot more nuanced than people make out. And I think also, we've had the event now, A lot of people had commented before it. If your view is exactly the same at the end of the event as when it started, it suggests to me you've taken on no new information. And I personally don't see how that's possible. If you actually watched it, if you didn't watch it, that's different. But if you watched the event and you didn't have a range of emotions, then maybe you didn't want to change your mind. And I think, I mean, Kelly was saying there, you know, people abused her online. Again, it's people who say they're passionate about human rights, but have no problem at all insulting people that don't agree with them. That maybe is just the platform. But, you know, Kelly had every right to watch the tournament. Put it this way, okay? You're not morally superior if you didn't watch it, and you're not more intelligent if you did watch it. You just made a choice about whether to watch a snooker tournament or not, and as I say, the viewing figure suggested a lot of people did watch it. The point I would make is that life isn't binary. You don't just have to have X opinion or Y opinion. You can change your mind, you can be conflicted. It's entirely possible to have believed we were wrong to go to Saudi Arabia with a snooker tournament, but still at the end see those scenes and think that's brilliant. It's equally possible to not have been worried about going to Saudi Arabia with a snooker tournament, but to have been concerned about the tone of some of what you saw. It's possible to have your opinions challenged. It seems these days, though, so many people wave their opinions around like a placard because they want people to applaud them. You know, Paul Simon got it right years ago in The Boxer, another song lyric coming up here. A man sees what he wants to see. Well, no, it's a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. That's the quote, which I mangled. Sorry, Paul. It's true, though, isn't it? You know, people very publicly decided their positions on this and stuck to them despite new information. I had a range of feelings watching it, some good, some not so good. But overall, Alpha asked the question earlier, was it good for the sport? I would say yes. And Tatiana Woolaston was mentioned there. We had an email to this podcast a few weeks ago, someone saying, I've heard, and what they meant was they heard on Twitter, that female referees would not be allowed at the event. Well, she refereed the final. I think that's quite big, actually. And, you know, she did. Her and Jan Verhaas did a great job. I mean, they could have done with another referee, really. But they did a great job between the two of them. They had to obviously deal with the golden ball and all that. And, fair play to them. I think Jennifer did strike on something quite important in her email about being seen. And it's Mark Chapman, going back to that podcast discussion on the sports agents. He actually made the point that he understands that he's looking at a lot of this as a white heterosexual man. And Ding's from China, the other players who went there are all white men who are not from a group that has been traditionally repressed. So they are maybe not as sensitive to some of these issues as groups that are in that position. And that's a fair point, and Jennifer's made it, and it's worth hearing. I think opinions on this will continue to be divided, and there will be no absolute resolution, but snooker's going to continue in Saudi Arabia. I think that's clear. And what I would like to do personally is go to Riyadh for the ranking event and actually see it for myself, because so much of the discussion has been Western voices talking on behalf of other people, talking on behalf of a culture and a country that they themselves have not even experienced. I would like to experience it. I would like to talk to people out there and see exactly how it works myself. And when I've done that, I'll be better educated on it. And maybe some of my opinions will change. And maybe I'll come back with a completely different view of it. I don't know. But that's the point. You don't know, really, until you see it. And I think with that, we will close this discussion for now. Simon Monk, a completely different subject here, says, hope you're well. Continued thanks for your excellent podcast. Thank you, Simon. He says, you were kind enough to read my recent email to you on your podcast, and if you recall, I did congratulate Gary Wilson on achieving his third ranking title, thus joining a very elite group. You were quite correctly asserted that this elite group does in fact total 29. Given since the early 90s, when we had a massive influx of new professionals, if you recall, we did at times have a ranking list of circa 500 players. I suspect over time, over 1,000 people have achieved professional status, so a total of 29 is still an elite group, I would attest. I caught up today with your latest offering, which was, as always, very enjoyable. One listener named Otto offered a solution around the mathematics needed to calculate the snooker's required stage. You read it a couple of times and conceded you were none the wiser, which is understandable in my opinion when you're spinning a lot of plates, so to speak. It's also, Simon, I'm not very clever. That's the other reason. But anyway, Simon continues, what I deducted was that if, say, for example, 3 reds remain, then experience tells us that means a total of 51 points is available. Otto stated that from the remaining total, the player in front subtracts his lead and then halves this answer. For example, if the player was 15 points ahead, you subtract this from 51, which leaves 36. If you halve this figure, you result with a tally of 18 points. So you can then work out how many shots are needed to reach the snooker's required stage. The player leading by 15 points would know that 3 reds and 2 blacks were taken past the snooker's required stage, as there would only be the colours left, 27 points, and you'd be 32 points ahead. 3 reds and 2 blacks is 17 points, so you can see that the tally of 18 is a good methodology or target, so to speak. We're back to Saudi here. Actually, I said we're changing the subject. Actually, he does mention Saudi. Thanks for the explanation there, by the way. I do understand it now. He says, I was interested in the Saudi event where you could go for the golden goose of 395,000 if you pop the extra ball. I totally agree with you. It'd be very difficult to make this pot if you stuck the white level or close to the ball cushion. These top players may decide to try and shift it. They're playing safe off a red and sending the white at the table from the opposite end. Well, this has sort of been overtaken by events. The amazing thing about that is it kind of didn't move, actually. It was struck a couple of times, double-kissed. But even then, you might expect, like you say, in a safety exchange, it's almost like they were sort of too reverential of the ball to go near it, in a way. Maybe almost a subconscious way, I don't know. But anyway, be a big prize next year for it. Now, what have we got here? Bear with me, I'm trying to find the next email. Here we go. Right, this is from Richard. Just watching the Alan Selby match at the Saudi Masters. What a match. So many twists and turns. And to win the match after needing 2 snookers in the dramatic way he did is something I thought only Selby in his prime could do. It's a bold statement, but is Mark Allen the new Mark Selby? Allen's safety is now rock solid. One of the best break builders in the game. A serial winner. And many of the top players such as Selby, Trump, Higgins can't seem to get over the line against him recently. Be interested to see how he fares at the World Championship this year. Maybe if he finally wins one, it could be a real change in the guard, so to speak. Anyway, love the podcast. Thanks for taking the time to make them. Well, thank you, Richard. Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. He kind of did out Selby in that frame. He's winning a lot of matches in a different sort of way to, I guess, how he used to. And the results speak for themselves. He's winning trophies. So people have been critical of his style. Maybe it's not the most aesthetically pleasing. And I've said that about Selby over the years. But he's winning tournaments. That's what he's in the game to do. He's my tip for the World Championship. I sort of revealed that in the Christmas special. That's not always a sort of lucky charm. But I think he's got a great chance there, actually. I suppose the question is, I mean, Ronnie O'Sullivan deserves to be the favourite. Who is best placed to beat him now? As I say, Trump seems to be struggling to beat him. A lot of the other top players, you know, we saw the UK, we saw the Masters, couldn't do it. I think Mark Allen could. They don't play very often, those two. So we don't have much to go on, but maybe it's all building up to their meeting. They could meet as it stands right now in the final. I think we'd take that, wouldn't we, for 2 days? But time will tell. It's coming up soon. And I did ask for predictions for the World Championship. So a seamless segue. Phil McCoy here, you asked for the name of who we think will win the World Championship. I'm going with Ronnie. Not original, I know, but I have that feeling. However, as this is sport, anything could happen, and I wouldn't be surprised if an outsider had the fortnight of their lives and win, as we've seen on occasions in the past. In the situations of being asked to predict a winner of a sporting event, I always think back to a line the late great Stirling Moss gave when he was asked who he thought would win the British Grand Prix. His reply was, if I knew that, I wouldn't have come here to watch. Well, quite right, but there's nothing wrong with a bit of speculation, I don't think. Now, Lars, who we heard from earlier, he's got a prediction. Actually, he doesn't. He has a banal meeting with a snooker player, so we'll come back to that, because that's a long-running feature. Phil Spivey, yes, here he is. He says, what a fascinating event in Saudi Arabia. I was sceptical beforehand about the golden ball, but it did create a buzz, and I liked how the score graphic turned gold when the player was in with a chance of a maximum. O'Sullivan is quite something. Wonderful performance from 2-1 down in the final. There aren't that many players who can accelerate to the line in the manner that he can. You asked for World Championship predictions, so here's mine, Judd Trump. He's been my tip since the start of the season, and nothing I've seen from him has changed my mind. O'Sullivan could have plenty to say about that, though. I also have a feeling John Higgins could do very well. His form has been excellent, arguably the best player this season, not to win a title. Ali Carter, the other contender for that label, is another player I suspect will have a good run, perhaps the semi-finals if he's in a different part of the draw to O'Sullivan and Trump. Whatever happens, it will be fantastic because snooker never disappoints. Loving the podcast and really appreciate the varied yet balanced views expressed by you and the other listeners. Well, thank you, Phil. Judd Trump, yeah, I mean, he's had a great season. People could sort of argue, well, he's peaked maybe, and maybe he has, but he might come again. You know, the Crucible is just so different to every other venue. The World Championship is different to every other tournament. My only concern about Trump, actually, is he always seems to start poorly at the Crucible. Quite often, I mean, even the year he won it, he only just got over the line against Tepchar and Nu, who was a little unlucky not to beat him. And then he got much better, obviously, and by the end was absolutely unplayable. He's playing some of the best snooker we've ever seen at the World Championship in the final. Now, of course, last year he started slowly and lost. That's the danger. You know, you're vulnerable to those qualifiers, Anthony McGill beating. So that's my concern. If he could start the tournament a bit more strongly, then maybe, it could be his year. We'll see. Just looking for other... See, people would say you've had perfect chance to get this podcast into shape before you start recording. But then what's the fun in that? Here we are, Lee Wall. Now, back to a previous matter here before we get to the prediction. He said, I'd like to thank John Skilbeck for his follow-up to my query about concession gate between Patsy Fagan and David Taylor in 1982. I was very impressed that he garnered comments from both players and the referee regarding the incident. By way of gratitude, I've now purchased his book, Goody Two Shoes, which I look forward to receiving once it pops to the letterbox. There you are, John, you've sold a copy there. He said, you asked for our Crucible predictions, and my pick is Mark Allen. He's arguably now the best player to never win the tournament ahead of Jimmy and Ding. He has always been a quality performer, but he's really kicked on in the last 2 years, getting himself physically fitter and seemingly in mentally much better shape as well. This has led to him being a consistent winner, and I back him to get the job done in Sheffield this year. Thank you, Lee. And if you purchase, and this is a blatant advert, but if you purchase, I'm not on any money for this, by the way, but if you purchase the World Championship programme, you could read a piece about Mark Allen written by myself. And it's written through the prism of following in the footsteps of the two Northern Irish greats, John Higgins, Alex Higgins and Dennis Taylor, who I would argue, of all the iconic moments of the Crucible, and there's been many, featuring the two most iconic, Alex Higgins beckoning his baby in 1982 onto the stage, and Dennis Taylor potting the black and the celebrations that followed in 1985. And Mark Allen obviously would love to author something like that himself. So I think it's a good shout, but we'll see, won't we? You know, we literally don't know. James Scott, you asked for listeners' predictions for the World Championship, and since I'm both a listener and capable of the power prediction, I thought I'd bravely answer your question. I like James, he's quite sarcastic, which fits in with the general mood here. He says, I think Karen Wilson could go all the way this year. While he hasn't done too much this season, he's still second on the list of century makers for the season, and I believe his quality will show itself over the longer session matches. Of course, my prediction flies in the face of your prophetic vision, so I suppose Karen is on a hide under nothing. Thank you ever for the podcast. Yeah, I mean, he had the maximum, didn't he, last year? It's kind of forgotten, almost, that he had that, because obviously Mark Selby made it in the final. Made him 147 in the final, but Karen had one. And then in the next round, John Higgins just annihilated him. And that can happen with these great players. But he was playing some really good stuff. I thought he played brilliantly at the Tour Championship last year, and I thought he was going to win it, actually. Sean Murphy obviously beat him in the final. But he was sort of earmarked as a sort of crucible player in that dread phrase. And obviously got to the final and was in a few semi-finals. Last couple of years, that tag has sort of receded a bit, but you know, I wouldn't count him up by any means. Mark Williams, not that one. He says, to answer your question, my prediction for the winner of this year's World Championship is Ronnie after beating Mark Allen in the final. I don't usually bet, but immediately after last year's final, I placed a few quid on some players for this year's final, as I'll be there in person to watch it, and my cash out price for Ronnie is already more than my stake. A hard one to predict this year, though. Hope to bump into you at some point over the 10 days I'll be there, possibly a banal meeting or maybe even a chat. Thanks again for a great show. Well, yes, I hope so, Mark. Do introduce yourself. A bloke last year shouted goodbye by it at me in the street. So maybe I should turn up there with a load of T-shirts with it written on, but that seems grubby, frankly. Brian McGovern, he said, I just listened to your podcast regarding the cloth used on the table at the World Championship. My question is, how long does it take to get the arena ready before the Championship and get the sets in place, and how soon afterwards are the sets dismantled afterwards? I think Paul Collier would be a better man to ask. But it'd be, well, thanks a lot. Well, he don't do a podcast, does he? but it'd be interesting to hear your take on it. I know Nick and Phil had Paul as a guest on their podcast. Well, in terms of how long it takes to set up, they get there, it's not quite a week in advance, but it's a good few days in advance. They'd be there, for example, on the Monday, setting up the crucible, putting the tables in, getting the set in. They have to drop the stage. It's a well-established, obviously they've been there since 1977, it's a well-established operation, but it's quite complicated. I think it's well known the legs of the tables are on, well, they call them acroprops, they're essentially stilts, which obviously then it's quite difficult to get the tables level. And they know at that event more than any other that the conditions will be monitored. By the way, in Saudi, I did think the tables were excellent. The pockets, I thought at first, were quite tight. Then they seemed quite generous, but they weren't too generous. I thought they played fine. Anyway, that's not what you asked. In terms of dismantling it all, it's depressingly very quick, actually. Pretty much, you know, you have the ticker tape and the champion, you know, poses for photographs. And pretty much as the audience are leaving, the table fitters descend and start ripping it all out. There's no great sort of romance. Obviously, they've got a job to do. And they do it very quickly and they do it very well. But yeah, it's quite heartbreaking to watch. Matt Hewitt always seems to go in and watch it, which maybe says something about him. But, Matt from the WP Reserve, of course. But yeah, it's quick. They just tear it all out as soon as they can, because they've got other things to do. And of course, now, they've got to get the arena ready for the World Seniors Championship, which starts on the Wednesday. We have another prediction for the World Championship, by the way, which I missed. Lucas in Germany. Thanks for reading and answering my email in the last episode. No problem, Lucas. He says, at the end of the episode, you asked who the listeners thought would win the World Championship. You mentioned that it no longer seems as clear as it did a few weeks ago that either Trump or Ronnie will win. I think none of the two will win. Even before the Players' Championship, I already had the feeling that this is Mark Allen's year. So there's real momentum here behind Mark Allen. He says, I would have predicted a Mark Allen, Mark Selby final, but if I see it correctly, they'd be seeded 4 and 5, and therefore on the same side of the bracket. If that's the case, one of Ronnie and Judd will probably make it to the final, but I'm sticking to my prediction that Mark Allen will win. I always think, thank you for that, I always think round one actually is so important, and you could see any of these guys losing in the first round, you really could. But once they get into the best of 25s, the people you've mentioned there are always going to be favourite to beat anybody. We don't know who Mark Allen would... He might draw Neil Robertson, you know, if Neil looks like he's going to qualify. Imagine that. that would certainly change a lot of minds to think about predictions. He's like a hand grenade in that draw, if he qualifies, because we don't know if he will or not. But yeah, it'll be very interesting. Now then, Addy from Cologne. He says, a very good day to you, sir. Long-time listener, only writing in when I really can't help it. I do have opinions on most topics that you discuss on the podcast, but I don't feel the need to voice them every other week. Alas, not unlike me, is what you're saying, Addy, but I've got no choice, really, as the host. He says, today I do feel the need to get something off my chest, because it has been pestering me for months now. Also, I really need someone knowledgeable, that would be you, to confirm that I'm not just imagining what, for me, feels like an ever-growing nuisance in today's snooker world. P.S. I wrote this 2 days ago but didn't send it for some reason. Today, having finished listening to your latest episode, I found out that another listener has already touched on this issue. So feel free to skip the email. Then again, you've come this far, you may as well finish it. Well, I have, you're right. Says, my issue is with the seemingly growing number of re-racks, especially when there's no obvious reason to have one. In my memory, players used to play on until some sort of unsolvable situation arose on the table due to the position of the balls, when the referee gave a warning that the situation must be resolved in X number of attempts or else. Nowadays, I get the feeling that players simply agree on a re-rack when the table gets complicated, and they have no interest in solving the problem. The latest incident, which ultimately compelled me to write in, occurred just a couple of days ago, during a match between Kyron Wilson and Sam Craigie in the semis of Group 6 of the Championship League in Leicester, in the deciding fifth frame, no less. I've attached a picture of the situation on the table for your convenience. This being an audio service will not help many of your listeners, but some of them may have seen it, and hopefully groaned in agony that very moment just as I did. The reds are all over the table, but only two out of the remaining 14 on a cushion. The rest in potable positions, as all the colours. The white's on the bulk cushion, there's no easy pot on, and it's difficult to find a safe place for the cue ball, but that's it. Section 3, number 17 of the rulebook is aptly named stalemate, not re-rack at your earliest convenience. The table in question is not a stalemate, far from it. Whoever makes the next mistake probably loses frame and match, but that alone cannot be a legitimate reason for a re-rack. Maybe I'm just imagining things, but similar situations seem to occur more regularly nowadays. And in short, I don't like it. And that's been capitalised. He really doesn't like it. In the aforementioned situation, it's simply a lazy decision by both players, and in my opinion, not very professional. I know it's not in the rule book, but I believe the referee should have the final say in what constitutes a stalemate and what doesn't. That's just me. Curious about your thoughts. Thanks for all your good work around the sport. It would be significantly less without you. Well, it's kind of you to say that. I think, yeah, I mean, the picture you attach, it doesn't look like a rear act situation. The problem here, and you mentioned the referee. I spoke to a referee about this, and they said, well, the problem is, on what grounds can we step in and not enforce a rear act? Normally, as you say, they have to step in and enforce one. Because if the players are determined to have a rear act, the two players, what are they going to do? They're just going to roll up to balls, you know, ad infinitum. And then in the end, the referee will have to step in and say, you know, I'll give you three shots each. And they're entitled to say, well, hang on, we wanted a re-rack 10 minutes ago. So is it becoming more common, this sort of thing? Probably yes. There are situations that can be better resolved without starting again. I think possibly one of the reasons is, and the Championship League would fall into this category, there's so many frames of snooker to play now that maybe the players do look at it and think, you know what, let's just get on with it. Now, that might not be right, but I think that possibly is a factor. I think if we're still on six tournaments a year, this probably wouldn't be happening. Gary Park, thanks for the ever-excellent podcast. Thank you, Gary. In the following scenario, would a 147 break count on the ever-growing list of professional tournament maximums? It's the Riyadh Season World Masters. A player makes a 147 in the usual way, 15 reds, 15 blacks and all the six usual colours, and misses the golden ball. However, along the way, let's say when getting position on the yellow, the cue ball is cannoned advantageously off the golden ball. In other words, the break only continued at that point because of the cannon off an object that has been in play when no other maximum has been completed by any of the previous 200 break builders. Without the golden ball, the player on this occasion would have lost position and not made a 147. Does, could and should this go on the list of snooker's competitive maximums? I would like to hear your thoughts. Well, I'll answer that shortly, Gary, but other people asked, if someone made a 147 but didn't pot the golden ball, could you call that a maximum because they haven't potted all the balls? So that's kind of the opposite, in a way, to what you're saying. I think, basically, what would happen is both breaks would be recorded as a 147 with an asterisk explaining, you know, the specific difference in that tournament, the fact there was an extra ball. Joe Davis in the 50s made a maximum, and it wasn't ratified because it was played under a new rule, the play-again rule, which didn't used to exist, so play-again after a foul. It was played under those rules, and the sort of crusty custodians of the rules in those days thought, oh, well, this isn't snooker, this isn't proper snooker, we can't allow a break to stand with this rule. And even though there was actually no play-again involved in the frame, they still didn't allow the maximum to be ratified. So this is an old debate, but to me, you would count it as a 147, but there would be an asterisk explaining the fact that there's another ball. And indeed, on this, Mark Williams has written again about the 167 business. We had left this behind, but that's because I hadn't properly planned the episode. He said, I must admit, I had reservations initially on the golden ball, but wow, what excitement it adds. I've been lucky enough to see nearly all of the matches so far. He wrote this during the event, obviously. What a show the players have put on. I have butterflies watching John Higgins going for the 147 and willing him on. What a shame he came up short against the yellow to put pay to that. Tonight, as I write this, what a spectacle to witness. Firstly, the match between Sean and Judd, where Sean just played brilliantly and got beat. Well done to Judd for that. Then the Ronnie and John Higgins match. No words to describe Ronnie. Three excellent centuries en route to a 4-0 win. John didn't stand a chance. I really do hope someone's on for a 147 and golden ball again before this ends. Yes, it's an invitational exhibition, but it certainly hits the spot. The best are giving it their best. Thanks to you all for the great commentary. Well, thank you, Mark. And, yeah, I mean, like I say, I think they found a way to make that golden ball work. And it's only going to be in this event. No one's suggesting, you know, we're going to turn up at the Crucible, it'll be there. But for this event, like I said earlier, it definitely gave it some publicity that it wouldn't have got otherwise, I suppose. Now, some people would argue that, you know, that maybe that's why it was introduced in the first place, to sort of steer eyes away from other things. I don't know. But anyway, it worked successfully. I think we can say that, or I can, because that's what I think. Now, Giles Delavelt, he says, to the podcast reviewer that complained you talk too slowly, they can just slow you down. See screenshot attached. Now, Giles is attached to, you can listen to podcasts on double speed. You can also listen to them slowed down, is the point he's making. He says, I felt immediately defensive of you, as you're one of us, Snooker family. Hopefully see you at a beer at the Crucible. Well, thank you for that, Giles. The person was just saying, basically, you know, they hope that English is not their first language. Could you just slow down? But it turns out you can slow me down. many people be saying, yeah, we can turn you off as well. But thank you, Giles, for that. Now, Christine, extraordinary email here from Christine. She says, this comes firmly under the banner, some people just waste their life. Often when I hear people quoting how many ranking event wins a player has, I wonder how this relates to players in eras with less ranking points available. I believe the maximum number of ranking events in a season is 20. So I decided to see how it would look if, for example, Ray Reardon's win of the only ranking event in 1975 counted for 20 rather than the one in the overall total. I assumed anything after the Worlds each year counted as part of the following season. And I also assumed there are 3 ranking events left this year. Are both assumptions correct? Yes, they are, Christine. I know this is still a far from perfect measure, as a world does not equate equally to Northern Ireland Open, but if nothing else, it's given me a bit of practice on Excel. Replacing the usual top 3 of Ronnie, Hendry and then Higgins is a top 3 of Davis, Reardon and then Hendry. Steve Davis is a clear season worth of wins ahead of anyone else. Reardon is the biggest loser on the straight event count method, as his dominance came during the introduction of the concept of ranking events. Ronnie needs to win 3 more ranking events to overtake Hendry on this measure of dominance in the game. I'm hoping this will happen, as I always like to see him win. Sean Murphy falls out of the top 10, proving my gut feel that Peter Ebdon was better than him. The only thing that interests me is Ding v Selby. I feel Ding may go on an inspired run at some point, and he isn't as far behind Selby on this measure as the straight event count makes it look. I can't think of many things that would bring me more joy to an average snooker fan than to see Ding win a world championship. The above is probably something that is available elsewhere online and may well be a bit boring, so feel free to ignore or keep one side for a quiet week in the summer. Keep to one side. As always, your podcast is very much appreciated. Looking forward to Phil Yates coming on for another snooker player bingo at some point soon. He gets a lot of criticism online, but I think he's absolutely wonderful, and I hope he knows that he's appreciated. Thank you, Christine. Well, I mean, Phil is not on social media, and frankly, that's to his credit. But in terms, now that you... people will be listening to this saying, what exactly is she talking about? And I say that not in a negative way, because they can't see what you've sent me, is what I mean. But Christine has sent, she says, an Excel file. And she's gone through, as she says, it's a pro rata thing, basically. So she's saying, okay, if she's counting events as if they were all equal throughout every year, and has worked out, basically, who would be on top on that basis. And it's a long old file. This I don't think this would be online, frankly, Christine. But you've done an amazing job with it. And on a pro rata basis, basically, Steve Davis on 106, Ray Reardon on 87, Stephen Hendry 82, Ronnie O'Sullivan 80. So they're the top 4. John Higgins 69, and then we got Mark Williams 51. If you can find a way, Christine, to put this somewhere, I'm sure people would like to read it, because it is interesting, but that requires more skill than I have, put it that way. Now, Joe in Hungary, he starts the email, "Hi, Phil." Now, this may be another Phil Yates fan, we don't know, but anyway, I'll gloss over that, Joe. He says, "I recently saw the provisional 24-25 calendar on the World Snooker Tour website and saw February 2025 was empty. I know it's subject to change, but I'm curious on your thoughts as to which events may appear there." Well, it's a provisional calendar. The Welsh Open will be in February. And I'm not sure, maybe the German Masters, I'm not sure where that is in the calendar. But I tell you what, what might help, Joe, is if I actually looked at the calendar. So just bear with me. Welsh Snooker Tour. Here we go. No, that's the wrong one. Here we go. Right, so the provisional calendar. Now, the German Masters, yeah, goes into February. Well, the Welsh Open, it will certainly be there. And if there's no other events, I'm sure Championship League will fill it up, as it often does. So, yeah, that's kind of the answer to that. Joe continues, I also noticed that Ronnie, as of March the 7th, has a 79% win rate. Surely that can't be accurate. Is that because they changed his two wins in the Championship League to a 3-0 to 3-0 loss walkovers? Thanks as always for the great pod. Well, he has an 86% win success this season, so it's not accurate. And it may well be, as you say, that those matches... Will Snooker told the stats, it says he's played 47 and won 37. Now, if you go to Q Tracker, it says he's played 43 and won 37. So it seems that there are four walkovers, two from earlier in the season, and I guess two from the Championship League. But those matches weren't played, so he didn't lose them. he just didn't play them. So, yeah, I mean, that's not right, basically. The win rate is 86%. Now, banal meetings with snooker players. Sam Liddell. He said, long-time listener, first-time writer, big fan of the podcast. Thank you, Sam. He said, I had a banal meeting with a snooker player that's so banal, we didn't even make eye contact. This is exactly what we want, by the way. He says, a couple of years back, I was out in a pub in Newcastle for a few drinks and saw someone standing at the bar. I could only see the back of them, but immediately recognised the back of his bald head. It was Gary Wilson. I pointed him out to my brother, who agreed, but we weren't 100% sure. I looked at the shirt he was wearing. It was a Newcastle kit top with the name Gary written above the numbers. This confirmed my suspicion, but I needed to be sure. I walked to the bar, about three people down, and glanced over. I was right. I didn't bother him, as he looked to just be out with a few friends, but I was glad about my newfound ability to recognise people by the back of their head. Thanks for everything you do for our great sport. Well, thank you. And, yeah, I mean, I think Gary would be quite approachable in a pub, but, the fact he had a shirt with Gary written on, I suppose, was a big clue, to be fair. Anyway, it turned out to be him. Now, Lars, who we heard from earlier, Lars Johansson, he says, when I travelled to York back in November 2023, I visited a cafe for breakfast during my first day. Who walks in while I'm eating? Robert Milkins. I've been out and about in York for 30 minutes at that time, thinking this week will be so awesome. I'll see all the players if this continues. Not so. The milkman was the only player I did bump into. He ordered a breakfast sandwich and walked out. Me, I was too nervous to approach him, so no interaction took place. Banal by definition. And Lars continues, because David Burney contacted us last week. He said, I hope the BC Open was successful. Sorry to say I will not be able to make it to Richmond this week. I'm a 25-hour drive away. I hope our paths will cross one day so I can ask more about your excitement about snooker in Sweden. It's a long way to drive for a snooker tournament. So I think that's it for the emails for now, unless any more rush in. I'll just check and not no more rushed in while I've been recording. Well, in fact, we didn't do Duncan's World Championship prediction as promised. So he says, I would go Selby simply because he'll be in the opposite half to Trump and O'Sullivan. Well, you say that, Duncan, but actually, Mark Allen provisionally has gone above Trump. So at the moment, I mean, he's never the top four of the semis, or very, very rarely. But if it was, it would be Luca Brasel to play Judd Trump and Ronnie O'Sullivan to play Mark Allen, as it stands now. Now, that can change at the World Open because of the prize money, and obviously the Tour Championship as well, it can change. But it's not absolutely set that O'Sullivan and Trump will be in the same half. That will sort itself out. But anyway, that's it for this week. So thank you for all the contributions. We'll be back at some point. And that's the promise we always make. We'll be back at some point. But in the meantime, of course, we're proud members of the Sports Social Network. Do check out their other podcasts. And, of course, the Championship League concludes this week. That's quite interesting, I think, because... one thing that is the case at the moment, the champion of champions, there's only four players in it, so there's a massive opportunity, the tournament's coming up, for people to get a place in the champion of champions, and the Championship League could be a way in. Kyron Wilson and Neil Robertson, both in the winners group, they missed out on the champion of champions this season. Obviously, you've got John Higgins, who tends to win the Championship League. I think he's won it four times. Mark Selby, you might expect them maybe to win something else, but then again, maybe not. Stuart Bingham has gone a bit sort of AWOL of late, and his form has not been great. He's in it. Chris Wakelin, of course, he played in the Champion of Champions this season, having won the shootout, but he didn't go well. He was pretty soundly beaten by Judd Trump. I'm sure he'd like to get back in. And Joe O'Connor, what a chance for him. Of course, he won Group 7 with the maximum, 200th maximum and all that. So, it's going to be interesting. That's Tuesday and Wednesday, and then the players are off to Yushan in China, which is going to be quite a trek, actually. They have to get the bullet train, and they can't take the queues on the bullet train, so it's going to be a long way to get there, but I always think it's much further coming back if you've lost in round one. So that's going to be an interesting week. Look out for John Higgins possibly making his 1,000th century at that tournament. He's on 992 now. It's unlikely to make 8 at the Championship League, but he could make a few there. So maybe next week, or maybe the Tour Championship is where he would make his 1,000th century. But anyway, that's it. You can contact us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. But for now, as we always say, it's goodbye-bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.